If you use fasting, even in humans now, they're using fasting before and after chemotherapy, you get a better outcome. We know that, forget the chemotherapy. If you take cancer patients like lymphoma patients and fast them, the cancer goes away. The tumors shrink. And if you keep them on a whole plant food SOS free diet, apparently, at least some of them are able to keep their cancer away.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to the Eat Green, Make Green podcast. This is Pat McCauley, as always. My guest this week is the incredible Dr. Alan Goldhammer. Dr. Goldhammer is the founder of the True North Health Center, a state-of-the-art facility out in Santa Rosa, California, that primarily specializes in healing people via fasting. He is widely considered the world, if not one of, if not the world experts on fasting as a means to healing. He is the author of The Pleasure Trap, Mastering the Hidden Force That Undermines Health and Happiness. He also has a book called The Health Promoting Cookbook and is working on another one, all centered around publishing the science that he has done over the years. He's had numerous studies published in world-renowned medical journals and scientific journals on the profound effects of fasting on everything from certain types of cancer to high blood pressure to diabetes, and it goes down the list. And he's seen just about everything you can possibly imagine be healed via fasting, long-term fasting. So anywhere from a few days to up to 40 days with patients at his facility. So I've been so excited to get Dr. Goldhammer on the show. I fast myself regularly, intermittently, and then occasionally we'll do a day or so as a preventative measure, but it also just feels good in my body. But it's a topic that is of real interest to me. I hope it's of interest to you. And what a beautiful thing, really, fasting is. It's free. It costs nothing. It just takes a little discipline. And he is proving that it is truly when you get out of your body's way and you let your body do what it already knows how to do, which is heal, that fasting truly is probably the most powerful healing tool we have in our arsenal. So anyway, I'm going to let him tell the rest, but we get all into fasting. Without further ado, the one and only Dr. Alan Goldhammer. Times of related is your currency. Oh, you can spend. All right, Dr. Alan Goldhammer, welcome to the show. As I was saying in my email to you, you're the guy for fasting. You're the name I think everybody hears around the world when it comes to fasting, and specifically like multi-day longer fasting as a means to heal. Like I was saying, I'm just super, super honored to have you. I know you have so much wisdom on this topic, and hopefully we can share that with a bunch of people today.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, we've been doing this a while now.
Awesome. Well, cool. Well, for people that don't know your story a little bit, when did you first realize fasting was such a powerful healing tool? I imagine it's not something you learned in school or anything like that.
Well, I first got exposed to the idea of fasting from a book by Herbert Shelton called Fasting and Save Your Life. It was an interesting idea, this idea that people were getting sick from dietary excess, that they were eating too much, they were getting fat, they were developing metabolic syndrome. And then as a consequence, they were vulnerable to heart disease, cancer, diabetes, and dying even from infectious diseases. We know that dietary excess fat, and particularly visceral fat, seem to be one of the big promoters of the inflammatory markers that are associated with modern disease. And that fasting was a way of giving the body to rapidly mobilize and eliminate the consequence of dietary excess. It just made a lot of sense. People are sick from dietary excess. Fasting is kind of the opposite of excess feeding, and it gives the body a chance to mobilize and eliminate those products. So it was very appealing to me. In fact, so much so that I decided that I was going to pursue this is a career very early on. I was like 16 years old and thought that would be a good thing. Because I met a doctor who said it was the best job in the whole world because the patients did all the work. The body did all the healing, and all you had to do was take credit for the good result. And I
Yeah.
thought, that's the job for me. And I was inspired by a relative who was a medical doctor. And he said that when he heard I was going to pursuing alternative medicine as a career, he said, no, absolutely not. Nobody in this family would go to somebody like that, let alone become somebody like that. And that better I should be a communist spy. And so he was very upset. My father took me aside and he said, son, I don't know anything about this alternative medicine business, but anything that makes him that angry and mad, well, it can't be bad. So you stick to your guns and good luck to you. So he encouraged me. Ultimately, it's interesting. My dad ended up fasting for 26 days with us and had a fabulous outcome. He had been having
Wow.
TIAs and had lost his cognitive capacities. He had to retire from teaching. Does this long fast 20 years later, he helps us edit the pleasure trap. So,
Unbelievable.
that was very good.
So was there like a clear avenue for you to like, all right, you want to, you're interested in fasting and healing people, but was there like a, like, where do you even begin? Was there a job you could get? I know you became, you went on to be a chiropractor and study that a little bit. Like, yeah, was there a clear path or did you just have to blaze your own path?
I went to a chiropractic college in Oregon that had a broad scope, and they were had interest in nutrition and fasting, and so I did learn a little bit there. But then I went to osteopathic college in Australia, and I studied with the guy that was the person in the world that had the most experience with fasting. His name was Alec Burton, and he was an osteopath that ran the Arcadia Health Center. And so I had a chance to go to school there and then do a residency with him and learn how to use fasting to get sick people well. And so that was, 40 years ago. So for the last 40 years, my wife, Dr. Morano, and I have run the True North Health Center. We've had, 25,000 people undergo fasting. So we've got a lot of experience now doing this long-term fasting of anywhere from 2 to 40 days. And what we found is that this fasting does, in fact, like Herbert Shelton suggested, help the body reverse diseases associated with dietary excess. So we treat high blood pressure, diabetes, autoimmune diseases, and certain forms of cancer reliably and predictably. Now we've been in the process of documenting that, publishing in peer-reviewed journals, and helping kind of lay out a framework that shows that fasting is not only safe, as our safety study suggests, but also effective, at least in the conditions that we're applying it.
Yeah. And so yeah, as you mentioned, like I've seen, you had a study on a woman with lymphoma, you've done high blood pressure, you've done and it, what it was like stage three lymphoma I was reading. But everything, diabetes, like across the spectrum. So I
But
mean, go ahead, yeah.
it's interesting how that works. Like we did this, we published this one case. It was a stage three follicular lymphoma in the British Medical Journal. And they said, well, this is really impressive, but why don't you follow this patient? Because, typically about 10% of lymphoma patients will go through periods of remission, but they tend to recur. And so it would be really impressive if you could show that it was sustainable. And so we tracked her for 3 years and now 6 years, and she continues to be cancer-free. And as a consequence of the publication of that article, we now have 9 lymphoma patients that are in various stages of follow-up. And as those results are coming in, they're very encouraging. And we'll be publishing a cohort and hopefully eventually justifying a clinical trial. Lymphoma was interesting because the medical treatment for lymphoma doesn't work in terms of affecting all-cause mortality. And so it was not considered unethical to, get a person well. Whereas if you're treating traditional cancer, it's considered unethical to do anything other than the standard of care. And so you're able to use this particular window as an opportunity to show just what the body can do. And, it's actually really interesting. And again, now we're treating some stage four lymphoma with secondaries, and we're also seeing improvements there. So it does appear that something good is happening when you get out of the way and give the body a chance to heal itself. We published a study on high blood pressure. Originally, it was 174 consecutive patients with hypertension. 174 people achieved pressure low enough to eliminate medication. And we recently just completed a study with the Mayo Clinic looking at a subjects of 30 subjects and looking at high blood pressure and also cardiometabolic risk factors. And we were able to show not only were the people able to normalize their blood pressure, but at 6 weeks and now 1 year later, they were able to maintain their weight loss, their blood pressure, and their drug-free state. In fact, of the original 28 people that completed the study, 27 were off medications and one was on one half the dose of medications that they were originally. So it's extremely effective in treating high blood pressure for people that are willing to do dangerous and radical things like eat well and exercise and go to bed on time.
I love it. No, that's amazing. So what is right? Not that it really matters, right? But of course, everybody wants to know like why fasting works and what is actually taking place in the body. Do you have
Sure.
any insight into actually what's going on?
Well, it turns out it's not shocking. As I said, people get sick because they're fat. When they get fat, they get visceral fat. When they get visceral fat, they produce IL-6 and TNF-alpha and inflammatory markers and all kinds of downstream biomarkers that cause the illness. When you fast, some things go down and some things go up. For example, glucose and insulin go down. Well, that's important because hyperglycemia and hyperinsulinism, is an important factor in contributing, particularly diabetes and other conditions. IGF-1, insulin growth factor 1, goes down in fasting. Lower your IGF, pretty much the longer you live. Leptin goes down, and as leptin goes down, that's associated with reduced inflammation. Inflammation seems to be behind lots of the things that people are suffering from. Your blood pressure and heart rate go down with fasting, as does mTOR. mTOR is a mammalian target of rapamycin. And the lower your mTOR, the higher your autophagy, which is the way your body gets rid of cancer cells and gets rid of inflammatory, diseased, and broken down cells. In fact, Yoshinori Ushumi won the Nobel Prize in Medicine in 2016 for his work on autophagy. Autophagy is like how the body does housekeeping, and it's dramatically enhanced with fasting. The microbial load is altered dramatically in fasting. You have like 5 pounds of bacteria living in your intestinal tract, and those creatures are important parts of your immune system and your protection, but they can also be a source of toxicity. They can give off waste products, essentially pooling in your intestinal tract. There are products that produce inflammatory products in your gut that are a byproduct of the waste products from your intestinal mucosa. And for example, if you look at people that are on animal-based diets, they have completely different bacterial strain than people that are on plant-based diets. And the thought is that healthy guts have about 1,000 different strain of these organisms, and you want to have the kind of good guys and not the bad guys. And as a consequence, what you feed them determines what they give off. And so that's where, diet becomes an issue. And in fasting, it's like rebooting the hard drive in a computer. You know how you have a computer that's corrupted, you don't know why it won't work. You turn it off, you turn it on, starts working again. Well, a similar analogy in humans, when you shut it down with fasting and you turn it back on with a healthy diet, you get that normal repopulation of the gut microbiome, and it appears to correct a lot of the conditions associated with that, including ulcerative colitis and constipation, irritable bowel, a lot of the other conditions we think of with altered gut microbiome. As I said, inflammatory markers all reduce consistently, particularly across the board in fasting, and as does the pain that goes along with it, the chronic pain that's often associated with them. And basically, the main condition that people are dying from today, metabolic syndrome, all of the factors associated with metabolic syndrome are rapidly reversed during fasting. So there's a lot of things that go down in fasting. And not everything in fasting goes down. Some things actually go up. And so we look at the changes that happen. There's all kinds of markers like adiponectin, ghrelin, and AMPK, and different biomarkers that are associated with increased, for example, by mitochondrial biosynthesis. The actual energy producing components in the cells go up as AMPK goes up. And so that may be why these chronic fatigue patients often seem to respond to fasting. The more you have, the higher your adiponectin, the higher the ghrelin, the more the insulin sensitivities improve, which may be why the diabetics tend to respond so well. Most of our adult type 2 diabetics will normalize their blood sugar levels and eliminate the need for insulin and medication. Now, they have to keep eating well and exercising well because you're not curing their diabetes, you're managing, but you're managing it with diet and lifestyle instead of drugs. BHB is beta-hydroxybutyrate. That's the main fuel that your brain burns when you're fasting, as you convert from burning sugar to burning fat. Well, the higher your BHB, the higher your butyric acid, the higher your BDNF. And BDNF is a brain-derived neurotrophic factor. That's the chemical that's associated with protecting your brain from oxidative damage. And so, like, the other thing that does that besides fasting is exercise. And it's interesting, all the things you see in exercise, the improved biomarkers often also improve with fasting. Which is a little bit of a mystery because people say, well, wait a second, fasting, you're resting and exercise, you're vigorous. Why would they do the both the same biochemical changes in the body? And I believe it's because both exercise and fasting have one thing in common, and that's they undo the consequence of dietary excess. So, for example, if you take rats, genetically bred rats, divide them into two cages, everything's the same, diet's the same, everything's the same, except you give one rat a wheel so it can exercise, they will. And the rats that exercised, they find, didn't get Alzheimer's. And they said, why? And they found out, well, the one difference was the BDNF goes up a lot higher in the exercising rats, and the BDNF protects the brain from oxidative damage. And so it turns out that is true with fasting. It turns out it's true with exercise. It turns out it's true in rats, and we believe it's also true in humans. Insulin sensitivity goes up in fasting. And you can't, there is no drug that'll increase insulin sensitivity. You can take like drugs, metformin, you can take insulin to try to push the sugars across the membrane. But in terms of actually reducing insulin sensitivity, there's only two things I know that reliably do that: fasting and again, exercise. Exercise reduces insulin sensitivity, increases insulin sensitivity. There's something called cellular stress adaptation and cellular stress resistance, and that represents the fact that in healthy cells, can't healthy cells are more resistant to low sugar than cancer cells are. Cancer cells don't do well in a low sugar environment. They have a high metabolic rate. They suffer if they don't have enough sugar. Whereas healthy cells are biologically adapted to fasting, so they can function in a high ketone environment. And so when you take, for example, rats and, well, before I go into that, what they did a study where they took rats with cancer, again, divided into two groups. They give half the group enough chemotherapy to kill all the cancer cells, but all the rats die. So, which is not a good outcome. So they take the same rats with the same cancer and the same chemotherapy, but they do periodic fasting in those rats, and all 30 rats survive. And so
Wow.
the conclusion was that it turns out, according to Valter Longo in Journal of Metabolism 2015, dramatically increased cancer-free survival in rats that have they use fasting with. And they said, why? Well, it's because in fasting, there's increased cellular stress resistance and cellular stress adaptation. The cancer cells don't do well, and so they get wiped out by the chemotherapy more readily. And the healthy cells are more protected from the chemotherapy in the fasting state. And so the moment that was recognized, oh my gosh, you can increase the amount of chemotherapy with much less damage. Pharmaceutical companies said, oh, fasting is no longer criminal quackery. And it became cutting edge research. And so it's not that they're looking to do fasting. What they're looking to do is figure out how does fasting protect healthy cells and how does it make cancer cells more vulnerable so they can come up with drugs that are fasting mimicking drugs. That's essentially what we're talking about. So what they want is a drug that'll do to your body what fasting does, but without that nasty fasting, and something they can put in a pill or an injection so they can sell it. And so now there's lots of interest in how is it that fasting is protecting healthy cells. How is it making cancer cells more vulnerable? What we know is that if you use fasting, even in humans now, they're using fasting before and after chemotherapy, you get a better outcome. We know that, forget the chemotherapy, if you take cancer patients like lymphoma patients and fast them, the cancer goes away. The tumors shrink. And if you keep them on a whole plant food SOS-free diet, apparently, at least some of them are able to keep their cancer away. So there must be something
Crazy.
about boosting the immune system that is a good thing. Now, this is early research. The lymphoma stuff are case reports right now. We're trying to put together a cohort, ultimately a clinical trial. But in the case of high blood pressure, we now have a clinical trial and we have long-term follow-up. And it's been published in major peer-reviewed journals. And in fact, we have an article in review right now. We'll hope that it'll be coming out. We'll get notice later this month, but it's in a major journal looking at our one-year follow-up data, which is really the first time I've really seen good solid follow-up data showing that people can sustain the changes. A lot of the criticism is, oh yeah, great, you fast, everything goes good, but you can't fast forever. You have to go back and live in the world. And can people follow this diet that's whole plant food SOS free? SOS, of course, is the international symbol of danger, but it stands for the chemicals added to food, salt, oil, and sugar that make people fat, sick, and miserable. So we have a society where over 70% of people are now overweight or obese, and it's because we've put chemicals in their feed that fool their satiety mechanisms in their brain, and they constantly and consistently overeat. And those chemicals are salt, oil, and sugar. Salt, oil, and sugar are not food. They're chemicals, hyper-concentrated food byproducts we add back to food to stimulate dopamine, the pleasure neurochemical in the brain, and it leads us to overeating. And it's just it's an addictive response. It works on the same neurocascade that drugs and alcohol and everything else do. And that's why it makes it really difficult for people to give up on their addiction to salt, oil, and sugar. Because they have, the only thing that would be left would be to eat whole natural foods, fruits, vegetables, grains, legumes, nuts, and seeds. You'd have to give up the meat, fish, fowl, eggs, dairy products, oil, salt, and sugar. That's 95, 96, 97% of most people's diets. Because they're
Right.
not
It,
actually fruits and vegetables anymore. That's the
right.
decoration in the plate.
Right. And you can't live off that, right?
That's what they think.
Yeah. So I'm curious of the things that, first of all, that's absolutely incredible. Like all the work you've done and continue to do. I'm curious specifically if you know, like, what happens to the vitamin in nutrient levels, like the vitamin D and
Right.
things like that, that people are supplementing for with low levels of those despite dietary excess. What happens when you fast on
Well, you know,
those?
what's interesting is that a lot of times the problem isn't people eating the stuff, it's absorbing the stuff. And so what fasting does is it changes dramatically your microbiome, those thousand strands of bacteria that are living in your gut, affects the gut leakage, it affects your ability to absorb. And so people that are having trouble absorbing before fasting, often after fasting, they're able to absorb both their micronutrients and their macronutrients. Even underweight people sometimes will fast, and then they'll be able to start making better absorption of their food, and they can then regain their weight. So it's not just for losing excess, it's also for overcoming digestive and absorptive difficulties. Obviously, you have to be very careful when you're working with people that have deficiency syndromes or are underweight. Ideally, you replenish those deficiencies prior to initiating fasting, assuming you can figure out a method for them to absorb those nutrients. In the case of vitamin D, you know, this is a common deficiency syndrome we see because people are not getting outside in the sun enough, or they live so far north that they aren't getting enough sun exposure with the sun hot enough that it can actually form vitamin D, and you have to supplement that to correct it. For vegans, they're not getting as much bacterial contamination as meat eaters. Meat eaters get tremendous bacterial contamination with all their meat, particularly all that nice feces that are blended in there with the animal products. And so vegans have to supplement B12 because they don't get enough bacterial contamination in their environment. And so over months or years, they would deplete their B12. That's the only source of B12 is bacteria. And so we don't want worms and parasites, so we wash and clean everything, you know. And
Right.
as a consequence, unless you're eating animal foods with it with an inherent contamination, you have to supplement B12. And so we recommend 1,000 micrograms of B12 a day, and that virtually meets everybody's needs. We don't see B12 deficiency in vegans as long as they're supplementing with that. With the rest of it, you know, we try to avoid supplementation because it turns out that isolated nutrition, you know, has problems and it has potential benefits. The best way to get your nutrition is from your diet. And so we try to get people eating a whole plant food SOS-free diet, which gets them the vitamins and minerals and fiber and protein and essential amino acids that they need without having to take the pills, potions, and powders, which if you read T. Colin Campbell's book, Whole, you find out that nutrients from pills don't work exactly the same way as nutrients from food in the body. There's tremendous potentiation when you take whole foods in. And there are potential problems with nutrients. For example, vitamin A, almost every study that's ever been done looking at A as an antioxidant protective has found that cancer patients die more rapidly if you supplement them with A than if you don't. They've had to discontinue studies where they were supplementing A because the death rate was going up so high in the
Wow.
supplemented patients. So you have to be very careful. Vitamin C, you know, a common essential nutrient. If you supplement at high dosage, it can have rebound scurvy in pregnant mothers. I mean, there are problems even from the more benign water-soluble nutrients have potential issues. So I think that relying on a whole plant food diet to get the majority of our micronutrients is a better strategy.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, when the whole food is always better, right?
Well, and not only that, but most of the things people suffer from are not deficiency syndromes, they're conditions of excess. And so thinking you're going to take pills and potions to correct your dietary excess is delusional.
Right.
You know, what you need to do is eliminate the excess. And in order to do that, you have to eliminate the salt, oil, and sugar, which is full in your brain.
Right. The excess is preventing the body from operating the way it knows how to and the way it's supposed to, And if you remove that, then the body knows exactly what to do, how to heal, how to normalize levels of everything, more or less.
And you think about all the things that everybody you know is suffering from, virtually all of it's tied to dietary excess, almost none of it's deficiency.
Yeah, so you're doing between a couple day and all the way up to 40, 50 day fasts.
Well,
How are
we
you
don't
do
fast over 40 days routinely.
40 days? Okay, yeah.
The guy I studied with, Alec Burton, used to fast people 60 days routinely, as long as 100 days, but he stopped it. When I got there, he was no longer fasting people much over 40 days. And I asked him why. And he said, oh, because of the sleep deprivation. And I said, so patients have trouble sleeping after 40 days? He goes, not the patients, me. He was worried, it gets a lot more delicate after 40 days. So what we
Yeah.
do is keep the fast brief, what we consider brief, and we don't run into the complications that you might have on the very, very long fast.
Yeah, and how do you determine like what's right for each individual?
So we're monitoring, first of all, every patient. The way it works at True North Health Centers, the first thing they do is they fill out their registration forms, and we offer a no-cost phone conversation with me to determine, is this even something they should be thinking about? And to give them an idea based on their medical history, what kind of timeline we would be expecting to get the results they're looking for. Then they come in, they see one of our physicians, they go through history, exam, lab. They're monitored twice a day by staff doctors. They're staying on site in a controlled setting. And we go through that period. And we're basically using their physiology to determine when it is that we need to terminate it. For example, patient with high blood pressure, they come in 220 over 120 on five medications. First, wean them off their medications, fast until their blood pressure is normal, and then refeed them. So that may range from a week or two to, a month or more, depending on how bad their blood pressure is and how much of a hole they've dug themselves into. Same thing with diabetes. We want to normalize their sugar so they won't need to be on meds. If they have chronic pain, we want the pain gone. If they have lymphoma, we want the tumors gone. And so you don't know exactly how long to fast until you see how they respond fasting. And of course, we never let them go too long, because if you go too long, you go from fasting into starvation. If you stay in starvation very long, then you die. That would be really bad for our outcome data. So we've been very careful, 25,000 times in a row, to avoid that. So we're monitoring people carefully. And that's why we do exams twice a day, blood, urine testing, et cetera. And if you monitor electrolytes, if you do it right, we've proven in a fasting safety study, the first large-scale fasting safety study, that this is a safe and effective experience. So we looked at all-cause complications and published that paper. It was published in 2018. Involved all the subjects that underwent fasting for a period of 5 years and looked at all of their adverse events, and that was the conclusion of the paper. All of these papers that we're talking about are available freely on our foundation's website, fasting.org. If you just go to fasting.org, you can look at all these studies. There's also a search feature. You can search the fasting literature. It's a fasting compendium site. So it's a really good location for people interested in learning to see what's been done on fasting as far as the research is concerned, ours and other people's, including people like Walter Longo and others.
Awesome. Yeah, how often is it that somebody gets to close to 40 days and they haven't solved their problem where you would have to refeed them and then would they
Well, it does.
fast again?
Yeah, it does happen. In fact, we have
Yeah.
one case we published on there. This was a dentist with chronic cephalgia. She had a brain injury secondary to getting hit in the head with a pole, one of these outdoor tent poles, and she got a dural tear, dural tear and whatnot, and ended up with chronic pain. So when we saw her, she'd had constant daily head pain of 8 out of 10 to 10 out of 10 pain for 16 years. She was disabled, hadn't been able to work as a dentist. We underwent fasting. It turned out to be 41 days. And then we broke the fast, refed her for 6 months, then fasted her again for 40 days. And then it was the paper was published 6 years after that. She didn't have headache for 6 years. And now it's been 10 years. She continues to do great. So in that case, she was able to resolve this incredibly long problem with chronic cephalgia with fasting. It was interesting. We got her to 40 days, and she still had a little bit of low-level prodrome. She wasn't quite done, but she was, doing okay. But it was 40 days. We said, that's it. And she said, no, she needed to go one more day. I said, no, we only go 40 days. She goes, no, I have to go one more day. I said, why? She said, well, the men fast for 40 days, Moses, David, Elijah, and Jesus. But women always have to do just a little bit more. So we made an exception. We let her go to 41 days. Second fast was only 40 days, but now she's well. So, people say you fast people for 40 days on nothing but distilled water. And I say, yes. And they say, so do you, you also teach him how to part the Red Sea?
Yeah.
And I tell him it's in the wrist, you know. But no, our patients that fast a long time are in good company.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's amazing. So I also know you specifically help people with addictions as well, and I'm curious more so not on like food addiction and sugar oil salts type addictions, but in terms of like drugs and alcohol, what have you
Yeah.
seen when it comes to fasting
So
as
it's
a
really the same neurocascade, whether it's tobacco and nicotine. For example, most smokers by the end of the second day or maybe the third day of fasting have no cravings. Now, some people say, yeah, they're so miserable fasting, they don't even think about the cigarettes, but that's not true. What happens is all these metabolic processes are rapidly sped up. So the withdrawal effect that takes a lot longer feeding goes very rapidly. And then there's no triggers. You're not having all those cigarette triggers. And so smokers are able to successfully quit smoking very relatively pleasantly compared to in the fed state. Alcohol addiction, a lot of alcoholics, they will sleep sometimes for a couple of days. You may not be seem awake very much, but again, the physical withdrawal is often greatly modified. And again, part of it probably is because of reduced trigger, supportive environment, et cetera. Drug addiction can be more problematic. We're not super fans of using fasting in certain types of drug withdrawals just because it can get really hairy. But where we have used it in terms of cocaine and other things, patients can be a little antsy for a few days, but the rapidity with which they transition to a stable state seems to be benefited from fasting. The more insidious addictions is to oil, salt, and sugar, is the dietary pleasure trap. And that's a huge deal, whereas people can more rapidly transition to where good foods taste good. And that's important to get adherence. If food tastes like disgusting, tasteless swill, people won't eat it. And that's what healthy foods taste like to people when they're addicted to the dietary pleasure trap. But once they've done fasting, healthy foods taste good. They'll say, wow, this chard is so salty. Well, it's just what it's always been. It's just that now you can taste it.
Right.
The palate's all converted, you can taste it.
You've done a study on that, right? Showing that
Yeah,
your
we did a
tastes
fasting
actually
safety study.
change. Yeah, that's incredible.
People challenge me on that because they say, oh, they just think they're just so hungry, they think it's better, whatever. But what we did is we actually did a clinical control trial where we were able to determine the minimal threshold detection to salt and sweet. And we looked at it in a blinded way. We did it before and after fasting. And we found, and then we did adherence studies and we looked at their hedonic response to salty, fatty, sweet, fatty foods. And bottom line, what we found was that good foods tasted better after fasting, that your ability to detect sweet and salt was enhanced, and that the salty, fatty, sugary, fatty foods that appealed so much to people were less appealing once people had adapted. So it was on taste and adaptation. It was a really complicated study for us to do, but we did manage to get it and it has been published and it's available on the site for you to see.
Yeah, I know that happens through experience, having changed what I eat, and it's just simply like you crave what you eat
Well,
after a
now we
certain
can prove
period
that
of
it's not
time.
all in your head, that you really
Yeah.
do change your perception. I guess
Exactly.
technically it is all in your head because technically those changes are happening in the brain, but it's not
Right.
imaginary. It's actually the food really does change.
Yeah, for sure. So you mentioned when it comes to addiction there, you mentioned environment, right? And I'm curious, like I know with Pritikin, however you pronounce it, in what he would do with whole food plant-based diets and what you do with fasting, like to what degree do you think, aside from just the power of the fasting, that getting someone into a space and probably for the first time, you looking at them and saying, I can, you can heal, and believing in them and having a supportive community of people around them, to what degree do you think that plays a role in the
Well,
healing process?
I'm sure it has a role. Although I have to tell you, whether a person believes it or not, it always works. It does the same
Yeah.
thing. You don't have to believe it to have your blood pressure normalized. It's going to normalize even if you don't believe. You should see some of the antagonistic patients we've had that have
Yeah.
still done well. So it's belief may affect your attitude, may affect your action, but it's your action that determines the outcome. You put
Right.
a, it's just like weight. People say, oh, I can't lose weight. Well, this is 40 years and 25,000 people. And everybody I've seen responds in a very stereotypical way to weight loss. I had a woman one time, she said she wouldn't lose weight because she'd been on every diet and she always gained weight. And I said, "So you think you can violate the laws of physics and thermodynamics?" And she said, "Yes." And she went on the fast, and the very first day she gained a pound. And she was so excited because she felt vindicated. She said, "See, even on a water fast, I gain weight." But overall, she lost a pound a day just like everybody else. It's just that people can hold fluid. There's little changes that occur in weight. Now, that's another thing we did. A lot of people criticize fasting because they said, well, you lose weight, but you gain it right back, and it's just a waste of time. And what we did is we took 38 subjects and did before and after fasting with a DEXA scanner, where we actually did detailed body composition. And what we found was that, yes, people lose weight and they gain weight back, but they lose weight during fasting, which is water, fiber, glycogen, protein, and fat. And they gain weight back after fasting. But what they gain back is water, glycogen, protein, and fiber, not fat. They continued to lose fat. And not only did they lose fat, but they preferentially lose visceral fat. So although for a sample subject would lose 20% of their total body fat during 2 weeks of fasting, they'd lose 54% of their visceral fat. They'd lose 4% of lean tissue. At 6 week follow-up, we actually flew these people back and reanalyzed them 6 weeks later. Their lean mass was higher than at baseline. Their bone mass was the same. The only thing that was persistently lost was fat and preferentially visceral fat. And as we said, visceral fat's the type of fat that is thought to produce the inflammatory markers that's thought to be so deadly. And if you compare the ratio of visceral fat loss to fat, it's higher in water fasting than anything else that's ever been published.
That's
Yeah.
insane. That's
Including
insane.
the dead Dr. Atkins diet, may his filet of soul rest in peace.
Are there fundamental differences, or do you take any different approach when it comes to male versus female?
Yeah, well, we know that women lose weight slower. They are the people in our society that are genetically modified in such a way that weight loss is difficult. They're called women. They're full of estrogen. Estrogen is a fat storage hormone. If you inject men with a bunch of estrogen, they'd get fat, they'd grow breasts and get hips. If you inject women with a bunch of testosterone, they'd lose their fat, but probably get hair and get cancer and die. So it's probably not a good idea. But the bottom line is women do have a harder time than men, everything else being equal, at losing weight. If you put both people on equivalent diets, men will average 3 pounds of weight loss a week, women too. So there is biological differences. There are things that go wrong with women that correct in fasting that men don't have to deal with. So, if you're asking, are there differences? Absolutely. As far as it work, the processes end up being the same in the end. They lose the weight, they recover their health. It's going to be a little bit slower in women when it comes to weight loss.
So how do we, for people listening at home, right? So let's take, I guess, the average, like, fairly healthy person that is listening, that does their daily exercise, that eats, fairly well,
Yes.
doesn't have any health issues. Like,
Okay.
'cause I know, like, people come to you, right? There, it's like a last ditch
Well, there's
hope to
two
solve
kinds
their
of
problems,
people.
right?
Yeah, there's two kinds of people who come there. They call us True North Health Center, the last resort. But we also see healthy people that use fasting preventatively. We did a study recently. It hasn't been published yet. It'll be coming out shortly. And it looked at healthy people, what happens to their cardiovascular biomarkers. And it turns out, as beneficial as fasting is in sick people, in some cases, the changes proportionally were higher in healthy people than sick people. That there may be healthy people get the very most benefit of fasting. And there's two kinds of fasting that healthy people can think about. The most common type is intermittent fasting. And we encourage everybody to fast every day for between 12 and 16 hours. If you're trying to lose weight, you want an 8-hour feeding window and a 16-hour fasting window every day. And if you're trying to gain weight, you might have a 12-hour feeding window on a shorter fasting window. But the idea is you don't eat 3 to 4 hours before you go to sleep at night. You stop eating after dinner and you don't eat for 3 to 4 hours. And then in the morning, delay your breakfast until you've had a chance to do some vigorous exercise. That's going to give you somewhere between 12 and 16 hours of fasting every day, day in and day out. And that, even that little bit of fasting, according to Valter Longo and others, is enough to induce biological changes that in the long run are thought to slow the aging process and help you maintain a healthy vital state and also help maintain optimum weight, et cetera. So we've always done that for 40 years. We've narrowed the feeding window of our patients to 8 hours. You have three vigorous or three generous, low caloric density, high nutrition density meals during that time. So fruits, vegetables, grains, legumes, and nuts and seeds. You don't eat meat, fish, phthalates, dairy products, oil, salt, and sugar. And if you do that day in and day out, then you're going to be putting yourself in the best position to avoid the long-term debility that occurs at most people as they reach their older years. And then occasionally, and this we can't prove yet because we're just doing the research on this, it might make sense even for a healthy person to take some time off and rest and do a week-long water-only fast. We recommend doing that in a controlled setting, but if you can't do it in a controlled setting or don't want to do it in a controlled setting, you still have to do it right, which is mean there's history exam in lab to make sure you're a good candidate. There's rest. You're not working, you're not driving, you're not exercising when you do this. And you recover very carefully to avoid refeeding syndrome or getting really sick from overloading your system when you're coming off a fast. So I believe that what we're going to find is in healthy people that do that, whether it's yearly or bi-yearly fasting, they're going to end up in the long run not having the premature aging and debility that affects people as they reach their later years. We're going to be doing a study
Right.
actually where we track people for the rest of their life and be able to prove whether or not we're right about this. What I see in my patients now, and I'm getting these patients that are 30 and 35 years in on this diet, and their stories are always very similar. Number one, everybody they know is dead. Some of them are outliving their kids. And, in fact, my mom, when she was 93, she realized she'd outlived all 50 of her lifelong friends. They were all dead. And many of them used to make fun of her son's crazy diet that she was following and all that stuff.
Yeah.
In any case, she said, Alan, it's a problem when you get in your 90s because even the people 10 years younger are still too old to do have any fun with. They don't want to do what she wants to do. And she said, so she wants me to warn the patients if they're going to do this diet, make younger friends,
Yeah.
but a lot younger, not just a little younger, or pick a few that are health conscious so there'll be somebody left in the end.
Yeah, that's incredible. Well, if you need somebody for long-term follow-up on the intermittent with exercise in the morning, I've been on that for multiple years, so
We're going to look to
happy
enroll
to help.
2,000 subjects into that study. It's calling our
That's
Navigator
amazing.
study. And I'm pretty confident what we're going to find is just like these older patients I'm seeing now, is they'll still die when they reach their genetic potential, but they won't become debilitated for the last 20 years of their life. They won't find themselves unable to talk or move, lying in some nursing home bed waiting for their diapers to be changed because they've had a stroke or a heart attack or got premature cancer. And it's delaying debility that I think is the key thing we have to offer. We know you will die at some point. I mean, neither you or I is going to be alive 600 months from now, no matter what we do. So there's a limited
Yeah.
amount of, the question is, can we live fully in that time and avoid the debility? That's really what we're trying to pitch.
Yeah, for sure. Is there a story you mentioned the lymphoma study you did in that one woman as an example? Is there any other kind of healing story of a patient you have had? I'm sure there's plenty, but is there one that really stands out as something that has moved you?
Well, I think what moves me more than individual anecdotal stories, which we could talk about all day. I mean,
Sure.
we see these every week at True North. It's bizarre. But are the fact that we're publishing long-term studies with hundreds of individuals. Because to me, it's a lot more impressive when you have large numbers of people rather than individual anecdotal stories. And so
Sure.
I would really direct people to fasting.org and look at the studies that we publish with significant numbers of individuals, looking at these markers and also looking at their follow-up data. A lot of the problems is people will talk about short-term results and but not actually track those patients long term. And when you start tracking people long term, it involves not only getting well from fasting, but that means they have to have made enough behavioral changes to sustain the weight loss and sustain the improvement. And the fact that we're beginning to demonstrate that that can happen, to me, that's much more impressive than any individual getting well.
Yeah, for sure. So is there anything else other than the fasting and mixing fasting in plant-based diet, exercise? Is there anything else like you do with patients or that you would
Yes.
recommend as a preventative measure?
Yeah, one of the most important activities is sleep. So getting the quantity and quality of sleep you need to wake spontaneously feeling refreshed is a critical part of healing. The anabolic cascade of hormones associated with healing takes place during non-REM deep sleep. Not getting adequate sleep is a serious problem. Not getting appropriate activity is a serious deficit. And not getting a whole plant food SOS-free diet is also a problem. There are other issues too in terms of stress and stress management. It's not my area of expertise. I just tell people, look, stress is like Christmas. It's better to give than receive. So be generous.
Do people struggle out of curiosity with sleeping when they first start. Like if I fasted and I didn't like move my body for the first 5 days, I don't know if I'd sleep well or not. I'd be curious to know if
Yeah,
people.
sleep can be disrupted during fasting because your brain changes fuels from glucose to burning beta hydroxybutyric
Feel like you'd
acid.
have so much energy, right?
Well, it depends on the patient. Yeah, some people are
Yeah.
quite energized, but overall, the effect of fasting profoundly improves sleep quality. So even people with disrupted sleep oftentimes find fasting's almost miraculous. For example, a person that's waking up 5 times a night to pee because they've got benign prostatic hypertrophy. Now, after fasting, they're not waking up at all, or maybe waking up one time. That improves the sleep quality tremendously. People not eating 3 to 4 hours before they go to bed when they get good habits, oftentimes just that's enough to improve people's sleep quality. When they no longer have the chronic low back pain or the headaches or irritability, the joint pain, the swelling, if they can breathe properly, which happens after fasting, sometimes that will improve sleep quality. And I think improved sleep quality as a result of fasting is part of why we see such good results. Also, once you're out of pain, you can start walking, hiking, biking, swimming, doing activities. Once people start doing activities, blood sugar levels are better, weight control is better, apathetic control is better, stress management is better. So sometimes it's getting people out of pain that might be responsible for part of the healing with fasting. Diet, sleep, exercise, and everybody fasting every day and occasionally doing a longer controlled fast, I think is the key to avoiding the what people think is long-term inevitability of aging. Everybody wants to live a long time, but nobody wants to get old because they associate aging with debility. And it doesn't have to be that way. And that's what you see in our patients in their 80s and sometimes in their 90s, still sharp as tacks, highly active, energetic, oftentimes right up until the time that they go to sleep one night and don't wake up.
Yeah, I feel like that's the mindset shift that has to happen, that people like when I found out that like, it you do have a say in whether or not you have a heart attack or you develop certain cancers or disease. Like, I just grew up, my grandparents died in their 60s from one of those things. And just the mindset needs to shift that that doesn't have to be the
You
outcome.
can't 100% protect everything, but what it's kind of like, you can bet red or you can bet black, right? Well, you don't have to just bet red or black. You can bet red and black, and your odds of it coming up is a lot better. Now, there's still that zero out there. There's still the occasional outlier miss, but wouldn't you feel more confident going in if you've bet red and black that it's going to come on your color rather than if you could just bet one or the other, or maybe not bet any at all? And so what we're saying is you can't 100% protect yourself from bad things happening, but what you can do is dramatically reduce the odds of unnecessary things happening prematurely.
So what else? I know you've mentioned some studies, but what else are you working on? I know you mentioned a book that you're working on as well, a new book.
We have a book, it's called Can Fasting Save Your Life? And it's a summary of all of the work that we're doing and that others have done in relationship to the role that diet and fasting plays in helping reverse disease and prevent illness from occurring. We're real excited about it. We're just putting the final stuff in. We've got a publisher that's excited about it as well. So it'll come out next year, and that's been a long-term project of ours. We've got some great studies. All of our stuff that posts on fasting.org. We have 5 papers in review right now. Hopefully, they'll all be coming out later this year on work that we did last year. With our colleagues at Texas A&M, at the Buck Institute, as well as at the Mayo Clinic. And so now that we've been partnering with these major institutions, it's getting a lot easier to get our papers read and published. And so, I think the amount of stuff we have done and that we're doing this year is pretty impressive. A lot of really good work. And the results are actually even better than I thought they were going to be.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Well, before we sign off, I just want to thank you, number one, for your time. But secondly, just to give you a shout out for the work you're doing. I mean, talk about changing people's lives with no side effects, right? Just getting people healthy, and it's a beautiful thing. And you have certainly, at least from what I know, and I'm very entrenched in the world of wellness, your work is always brought up when it comes to fasting and healing. So thank you for what you do and all the people you help.
My pleasure.
And I have to ask before you sign off, you have a some sort of analogy that I've heard many times you say about flying across the country and people needing to eat. Would you share
Oh,
that
yeah,
with
it's
us? Because
true.
I always laugh at it and I love
Yeah, well, you know, it's true. People are
it.
so afraid of fasting. You know, there's something, you know, inherent in our instinct that, you know, people always want to just terrify that. And I said that if they get in a plane in New York and they flew all the way to California, they would die over Colorado from starvation, except they ate the pretzels. So they think the pretzels saved their life, and it's not true.
I love it. I love it. Well, thank you so much. Absolute pleasure having you. And again, I appreciate your time and all the work you do.
My pleasure.
Alan, thank you, man. I really
My
appreciate it.
pleasure. Thanks for getting the word out.
Yeah, for sure. I'll send send links and everything over there. If there's anything particular you want me to put or
No,
highlight.
whatever you, anything you do is great. And if you find yourself in our area, come by, let us give you the tour.
Thank you. Absolutely will. And it's so Northern California, whereabouts?
Santa
Remind me.
Rosa.
Santa Rosa. Okay.
Yeah.
Awesome. All right.
Very
Pleasure to
good.
meet you. All right. Take care.